Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And also by the Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. Check it out at fit.honda.com.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Holgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Coming up on today's show, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by The Great Distance, and a look ahead to our top five screen parents. But first, abandoned by Bryan Singer for this summer's other big comic book movie, Superman Returns, the X-Men franchise takes its last stand with director Brett Ratner.
The air is still, and the night has fallen. If there's any one question you must answer, who will you stand with? A major pharmaceutical company has developed a way to suppress the mutant X gene permanently. They're calling it a cure.
There's nothing to cure. Nothing's wrong with any of us, for that matter.
You of all people know how fast the weather can change.
After creating an uneasy alliance with Magneto's Brotherhood in 2003's X-Men United, Charles Xavier's X-Men find themselves at odds with just about everyone, including old foe Magneto, the United States government, and one of their own in this third and possibly final chapter of the series. Adam, we just celebrated Memorial Day, traditionally the threshold of the summer blockbuster season, but already we are very much in the thick of things. Our thoughtful discourse on United 93 seems like ages ago. And now here we are reviewing our second part three in 3 weeks. Mission Impossible 3 surprised both of us a couple of weeks ago. We both like the energy and strength of storytelling that director J.J. Abrams brought to the film. The third part of the much-beloved and widely praised X-Men series has a lot going for it. Two solid predecessors with a sequel even stronger than the original, and a full stable of returning actors, and one possibly dire thing going against it, director Brett Ratner. 20th Century Fox's wildly and possibly unfairly loathed choice to replace original director Bryan Singer, who left the series to direct this summer's other big comic book movie, Superman Returns. The man behind the two Rush Hour movies and the unnecessary remake of Thomas Harris's Silence of the Lambs prequel, Red Dragon, originally and quite brilliantly filmed by Michael Mann as Manhunter in 1986, Ratner carries the reputation of a particularly reviled gun-for-hire, a hack, a latter-day Joel Schumacher. Tell us, Adam, have fans' worst fears been realized with this third part of the X-Men series? Will we all have to pretend that X-Men: The Last Stand never happened?
Well, I can't speak for diehard X-Men fanatics, and to quote John Bender from The Breakfast Club, I'm not even sure I speak their language. I haven't been reading their comments, but as a fan of the franchise, I would say that no, our worst fears have not been realized. And it would actually be a shame to pretend, I think, Sam, that this installment never happened, because ultimately it exceeded my expectations. I saw it with my brother-in-law, Sean, Monday night. We both thought it was a fun, entertaining movie. The worst of the three in the series so far, but entertaining nonetheless, and something I will actually recommend to people. I think you've got some interesting new mutants added to the mix. The whole Jean Grey Phoenix storyline is interesting. I kind of like seeing Pyro kind of emerge as a little bit of a badass, though his showdown later in the film is a downer, doesn't really work. The cure story, this whole idea of these mutants having the option of curing themselves and the government wanting them to be cured, is the most complex. It's the most interesting one yet. You've got all these overtones of not only gay rights and them being in line for the cure, and people chanting at them reminds you of people going in for abortions. Mm-hmm. You have all these interesting political overtones dealing with social issues facing us today, like all the X-Men movies have done a really good job at. The execution kind of fails, maybe we'll get into as our review goes on. And the action scenes, I think, for the most part, work pretty well. That all said, it's far from perfect, and it's not even great.
But
and
I've thank got you for starting off with the things you like.
The things I like, exactly. And I've got a laundry list of things I didn't like, but let me just start with one thing, and I'm sure I'm person number 5,000 who's brought this up, but there's something just inherently unsatisfying, of course, about this trilogy, and the fact that with any trilogy, you've got that third film that's ending it, and it's the end. It's tying together all the loose ends, and then that is especially unsatisfying when they're tying all the loose ends up, but leaving a few of them open just in case this one's really successful and they're going to end up making a fourth one.
Well, how could they not think it was going to be successful?
Exactly.
Really?
So you've got just that aspect. You think about, of course, the Star Wars trilogy. Most people, and I agree, Empire is the best one, just like X2 was probably the best one, because you've got all these conflicts and ending on kind of a down note. And then you've got Return of the Jedi, and everything gets tied together nice and
with
neatly.
With Ewoks involved,
And it's the same thing here, minus the Ewoks. So I think just by its very nature, it was probably going to be a little bit unsatisfying.
Yeah, but like you, I think I went in with kind of diminished expectations here. I mean, the fact is, I mean, there's been, when Ratner was announced as the new director, and I think some of the screenplay might have been leaked last year, maybe last summer. I mean, I have a single friend anyway, who's a fanatic, and was just thinking this was going to be an absolute atrocity, and I sort of took his word for it, or his fears, his terror for it. You know what? I've never seen a Brett Ratner film. I've never seen a Rush Hour film. And
really?
I did not bother seeing, the Manhunter remake.
Okay. I've seen all three,
just for the record. So the fact is, I was just relying on people's abhorrence of this individual. And the fact is, yes, he directed like Mariah Carey videos and Madonna videos before getting into Rush Hour. So there's not a lot to like there, maybe. But the fact is, like, so I went in with pretty reduced expectations, like a 3. On a 1 to 10 scale. Looking back at the film, like the way the film opens, I realized how much I was willing to overlook the kind of weak openings. The weak opening. I mean, it does start with like this 20 years ago and then 10 years ago. And then, most terrifyingly of all, because I didn't know anything about the plot, we get sometime in the distant future.
Right.
And I thought, well, this is just going to be a mess.
Not
because we have lasers. We really have like the first scene in the Terminator, actually,
is
what we're seeing. And, I was very scared, and that is sort of a faux opening in some ways. And at least one of the three openings, the 10 years ago sequence with the introduction of the Angel character, which is just a completely wasted subplot.
Completely wasted.
Totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
But there probably were few scenes that they just wanted to keep, so they wanted to keep the character in the subplot. But anyway, that being said, I totally agree with you. I really had a good time with this movie. I actually hadn't seen X-Men 2 until very recently. I went and caught it in time to see the third part, and you're right, it's really strong. Just structurally, I think it's really sound. And I think this will be seen, the Last Stand, will be seen as the kind of weaker, the Return of the Jedi kind of film in the series. But I don't know, for me, the first never did much for me, and people are so willing to praise, and I think overpraise, Bryan Singer, who I think is a pretty standard director. I think the X-Men series has really, it's taken itself serious. I like what they've done in terms of, the sort of political and social overtones. I think that's allowed the film to the series and the characters to have some strength and some relevance.
Mm-hmm.
Singer is a working man kind of director. I don't see him as having any particular qualities, particularly. I mean, he's got just as much discomfort, I think, with the emotional lives of the characters as Ratner does. I don't think he does any worse or better job. And, I am on the record, of course, as not really particularly liking The Usual Suspects all that much. So I'm just not on the Singer bandwagon here. But I think Ratner does a fine job. I mean, the script isn't perfect. His execution isn't perfect, particularly parts of the sort of showdown at the end are a little weak and generic. And there's a lot of sort of generic and unnecessary subplots throughout. But I really enjoyed myself, have to admit.
Well, I will say, in Bryan Singer's defense, I think actually if you look at this film really closely compared to the other two films, you will see some real examples of why Bryan Singer is a much better director than Brett Ratner. And I know that probably goes without saying for most people, but really if you look at it, even though this film is on the whole fine, as we said, we both had an entertaining time, we both enjoyed it. The thing that was really lacking from this film, and you might be right, Singer might not be any more apt at handling the whole emotional aspect of some of these character arcs than Ratner is. But what he can do much better than Ratner is, first of all, he's much more witty and he's much more clever. The jokes in this film.
But I think overall there hasn't been a lot of wit to any of these films.
Well, I disagree. I think if you look at the other two, I think you do see it, especially with the Wolverine character here. All of his lines are really
pretty
stupid.
Lousy,
and the punchlines in general are just really ham-fisted in the way they're delivered, in the lines in general, and they're just bad. And he doesn't do anything to make the screenplay any better with his direction. I think in general there's a lack of wit that you see. But I also think that you see something lacking in, there was never really, as much as I got into some of the scenes, and especially the Jean Grey Phoenix scenes with Xavier in particular, those are really interesting scenes. There was never that real feeling of tension and suspense that I got watching in the first movie, just watching Magneto and Xavier talk to each other. Mm-hmm. There's a real feeling of tension there and just suspense almost, watching two people sit and talk. And Singer pulls that off just in the way he handles the editing of the scene and the rhythm of it and the shots. And here you watch Ratner, yeah. and it's done in this almost TV kind of ER style where the camera's always swirling and the edits are really faster paced. Mm-hmm. And it just never builds that kind of tension that I got from the first film. This really felt like kind of stock direction to me, whereas you could go back and pick out certain scenes in X-Men that seemed to me like kind of signature Bryan Singer scenes. You never see anything like that here.
No, that's true. That's true. And I think what Ratner has inherited, as well as like a strong story, is a good group of actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ian McKellen, I think, is... I was thinking about what makes him so special, yeah. and really what makes him so special in this performance, as well as in like Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings series, where it's like you have somebody that brings weight and real gravity mm-hmm. to the proceedings, to some really pretty ridiculous proceedings. And I was thinking particularly of a scene towards the end where Magneto has one of these like huge action set piece moments. Fair to say, I mean, I don't know, it's not in any of the previews, but he sort of like takes a bridge basically.
You could watch the scene online,
yeah.
so...
Okay, just so I can have you picture this. I mean, yeah. he really has to just extend his arms, and we just have to believe mm-hmm. that, you know, Ian McKellen, Magneto, is lifting a, you know, a 1,000-ton foot... I mean, really, the Golden Gate Bridge.
That's it.
And I don't know if anyone else can really pull that off, and he does, time and time
right.
again. And McKellen comes from a theatrical tradition, and I actually had the pleasure of seeing McKellen as Captain Hook in Peter Pan in London. And I was thinking about him, it's like, as a theater performer, you are the illusionist. I mean, if we were to see the X-Men stage version, mm-hmm. you know, Magneto, we'd have to believe, there would be no bridge on stage,
right.
but we'd have to believe it anyway. And McKellen is able to use those
yeah.
theatrical skills here, which I think a movie actor... maybe not be able, wouldn't be able to pull something like that off.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know, the casting of Patrick Stewart and these classical actors and the way they tell the story, I mean, you can't say enough about how much that adds to the experience.
No, I completely agree. And I think maybe he shines here even more than in the other films mm-hmm. because he's working with such a weaker
Agreed.
Screenplay, and yet he stands out.
As
he still
did in
out.
The Da Vinci Code just last
In the
last
Da Vinci
week,
Code,
yeah.
which, again, you didn't have the pleasure of discussing that review.
Of all weeks to miss, I couldn't have been happier to have
right,
missed that one.
On yeah. air, but it turns out you did pretty much agree with
yeah,
everything
100%.
Scott and I,
yeah, I really
had
did.
To say about the film. And we all agreed that Ian McKellen was about the only
Absolutely.
Thing that was really fun about watching that film.
He was having
and
a good
here
time.
He stands out. Again, he really, 2 weeks in a row, it was a blast to watch Ian McKellen. He does a great job. And I think that unfortunately, you know, and again, there's kind of a laundry list we could probably go to of bad moments and things that don't really work. But that Golden Gate Bridge sequence is unfortunately one of the things about the film that really doesn't work. And it's mm-hmm. sort of an example, I think, of not only the inept screenplay, but maybe Ratner's kind of direction where it's just over the top for the sake of being over the top. Let's break this down here. Magneto needs to get from
totally.
One side of San Francisco
oh,
to Alcatraz. He just needs to go across
that's
the
it.
Water. Okay?
And he can fly.
Now, I did think about this after the film. I was thinking about how annoyed I was with this sequence.
Right.
And I realized that, of course, it's a nice little moment where, metaphorically, he's taking this monument of human creation.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Well,
and
you're giving
do you
Zach
think I'm giving
Penn and
Simon Kinberg.
And Simon Kinberg so much
too much credit.
Here.
He's taking this monument of human creation, the
yes.
the ultimate thing
engineering
we can do,
feat
engineering feat and he's just using it like you said, I mean, just with the flick of a hand he can
yeah.
move it to wherever he wants, so maybe there's something there to it, but the fact of the matter is he can take a boat just
or maybe
like anybody else.
We look at the actual line that he was given. He's like, well, Xavier always said something about building bridges.
Oh, I know, which was awful.
Wow.
just awful. And there are a ton of moments like
there
those
are.
Kind of punchlines
yeah,
that don't
are.
work. But anyway, as I'm saying, I mean, he yeah. can just he can pick up any piece of metal, any boat, any car, whatever, and stand on it and bring
yeah.
everybody he needs
yeah.
over
there
to
aren't
that
many
side.
Of them.
And it's just kind of ridiculous that he has to use the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's just
yeah.
one of those moments of, again, kind of being big for the sake of
yeah.
being big.
Well, you just imagine them like
sense.
They're in the bullpen. Ratner and Kinberg and Penn. And Ratner's like, amp it up.
Yeah.
Amp it up. I got $150 million to spend
exactly.
on the Golden Gate Bridge to go over to Alcatraz.
Yeah.
And,
you know, another moment, again, that's not only, I think, the direction, but mainly the writing is there's a line where Pyro wants to go get into the attack, and we're not giving really anything away here, and Magneto holds him back and says, no, let the pawns go first. And then we see this the attack, the counterattack, and
it's
a bunch
glory
of,
all over again,
yeah,
really. Yeah.
Right, that's it. And a bunch of the pawns die,
yeah.
and they cut back to Ian McKellen so he can say, that's why the pawns go first. Yeah. Now, if you would just cut to him and had him say, that's why the pawns go first, and not had the line before it.
We don't need both.
You don't need both. It would have been great. That line actually would have worked. Instead, again, it's kind of that redundancy that's hitting you over the head. There are so many moments like that. I mean, even these lame moments of the president looking dramatically at a screen saying, then God help us. Yeah. They're just, the screenplay is not nearly as tight as what we saw in the other films.
Or as we saw in Kinberg's masterpiece, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, from last year.
Don't go there, Sam.
But I have to say, too, we talk about like the structure of the story really in terms of using this parallel to homosexuality or to social events, and I think it's overstating it to say like they're doing something important at all, but what it does by doing that is just like it gives relevance to the audience. It just lets us like understand and sympathize with the characters, and I think like you can't say enough about that. It's something that, you know, J.J. Abrams and his team of writers did so well in Mission Impossible 3, making it relevant to the audience.
It grounds it somehow in a way that like a movie like the Fantastic Four doesn't, and it adds
weight to it.
Or you
think of like the Bond series. It's just like we have to just understand like an evil guy destroying humanity. Right. I think it's harder to accept things like that.
Yeah, and I think we're at a good stopping point, but I just want to make my last point about what didn't work about the film, even though ultimately, like I'm saying, I'm recommending it. But one thing is that idea, like I said, is I think this storyline of The Cure is the most complex
and
really intriguing one yet. And you've got this interesting dilemma where mutants at the end have to make the decision to kill other mutants. Other mutants who really just are fighting for their freedom and their right to be mutants. And you don't see anything like that in the previous two films. Yes, they're killing other mutants, but they're Magneto's mutants. They're these people that have decided to be renegades, whatever. That's all fine. They're kind of these two superhero teams fighting against each other. Here you've got regular, plain old mutants like you and me, Sam.
Yeah, just like you and me.
And, you know, you've got Wolverine just slicing them up left and right. Yeah. And the movie, unfortunately, has this great storyline, this great complexity that could be there to mine.
Right.
And unfortunately, Ratner and the screenwriters are just more interested in showing Wolverine slicing these people up than ever really getting into it. And yes, there is that one moment where the characters have to look at each other dramatically and decide whether or not to take a major plunge and do something that kind of is unethical for a mutant to do. We get that moment. But for the most part, there's this real ambiguity that Singer is willing to go with and really explore that Ratner isn't.
He just doesn't have the strength of complexity. Yeah. It's true. All right, well, if you've seen X-Men 3 and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, he's on his final hole. He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think. Between us and our special guests, we listed over 100 great performances on our special 100th episode a few weeks back, and according to you, we still missed a few. Listener feedback, including your thoughts on The Da Vinci Code, is next. Plus, stick around for your chance to win a free DVD in Massacre Theater. Back in a moment.
You changed all your savings to dollars, convinced you would never come home. Now it logically follows I'm gonna spend my lifetime alone. Please, baby, don't ask me to come. I spend my life hiding. It's too late to go on the run. Cut out the dead wood. It won't help you. Watch as you soar away.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. And Sam, before we get to our Peer Flicks DVD winners.
It's my first time I get to say Film Spotting.
Film Spotting, I know.
It
weird,
feels good.
Isn't it? It does feel okay, though.
Yeah, it's all right.
You wanted to take a few moments to just close out our discussion of X-Men?
You mentioned the character arc of the Dr. Jean Grey, who was killed off, apparently, in the last film, and emerges here not just as Dr. Jean Grey reemerged, but as Phoenix. And I have to say, there was a moment at the end of this film, and you've criticized the handling, the execution of the final sequence, but from the moment when our sort of core X-Men decide, let's go out there and we need to battle, we need to sort of defend the U.S. government really against the rest of the mutants. I had an experience that carried me through the end of the film that was really unlike, as I could recall anyway, in the experience of watching a comic book adaptation, which was, it reminded me of what it was like to read the comic book. Which is, for that alone, I think it was, I have to recommend this film, because there was something that was sort of always happening in comic books. And I wasn't a huge, avid comic book reader, but it reminded me of those comic books that I read where it's like the small group goes and faces the larger group and they're totally outnumbered. And there was a sense, too, with, and I think I have to tie this in, with the whole Phoenix character. That felt very comic booky. You know, it's just like the dual nature and the ferociousness and the sort of otherworldly quality of the Phoenix. I mean, there was sort of terrifying moments.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yes, this movie was directed by Ratner, but I think he handles that character really well. I was reminded of the Cate Blanchett character in the Lord of the Rings series, where it's like this truly terrifying otherworldly magical power, and the way her character is described as possible, you know, as having the power to really eliminate all life, as that being her mutancy. I don't know. I was like, that felt very comic booky, successfully comic booky to me. And I really admired that.
It worked really well. I agree completely. I also just wanted to add two other quick things. And that is, it's always fun for me as someone who did read the X-Men comic books growing up, though not avidly like you probably didn't and some of our listeners, is it's always fun just to see Wolverine be a badass.
Oh, yeah.
He gets to really be a badass in this one. I mean, he has in the other two as well, but really throughout this whole film and especially at the end, that's always fun to watch. Hugh Jackman does a great job, again, with a bad screenplay.
Yeah.
He's really good at
being such a presence.
Wolverine. Yeah,
and
he does have a great
presence. Interesting
side
note, I just want to take a moment here because Halle Berry, again, is just such a weak link in this cast.
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't know.
I think Storm in general is a weak character.
It is. They don't seem to know what to do with her. Rogue, after having such an important role in the first film, has been left to this lame love triangle subplot the last two films. But Halle Berry particularly, and I wish I didn't know this, but it actually, and maybe listeners wouldn't want to know this either, but apparently she complained and she said she wasn't going to be in this third film because she didn't like the lack of character development for Storm. And so they beefed it up.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she sort of inherits the Academy in some way, or she's seen as the inheritor of the Academy.
Right.
And you know that was only just to satisfy her ego in some way, and you don't quite buy it. I mean, if anything, there should be something like where Wolverine assumes some sort of responsibility and takes over the Academy
maybe.
In some way. I'm just saying, like, it's an unnecessary kind of an unbelievable.
I have to say, on the whole, I actually kind of like the idea that they beefed up her character a little bit because she was so flimsy in the other. So I kind
she
of didn't mind
flimsy.
That.
The last, she didn't need to come back.
Maybe not. The last point is just you alluded to this, but this whole idea of Angel, unfortunately, what an interesting character this could have been.
Yes.
And they literally just have him sort of flying around periodically in this movie.
And the flying around is not so good.
No, it's not. And I know that this is probably because if they do, you know, X-Men The Next Generation here with X-Men 4, he's going to be a featured player, which is great. But they really needed to do more with him here if they were going to include him at all.
And he needs more powers.
He does.
He has a great pair of wings, but otherwise, I don't know. He needs lasers out of his eyes or something. Or maybe he can make people fall in love.
Maybe so.
I don't know. I want that.
That's a thought. Okay, well, that closes the book on X-Men.
Yeah.
Our last stand on X-Men. And it is worth seeing. We agree, though flawed. Definitely flawed.
Yeah.
Couple of PeerFlix DVD giveaway winners to announce. The Napoleon Dynamite winner from last week is Shannon Cody from North Liberty, Iowa. Go Hawks. And the winner of the Patton Special Edition, which just came out on DVD last Tuesday, is Scott Hart from New Orleans, Louisiana. So congratulations, Shannon and Scott. Look for those in the mail from PeerFlix soon. And in an effort to honor the truest DVD fans out there, PeerFlix is happy to announce the launch of the Show Us Your DVDs contest. PeerFlix is searching for the shrine that best symbolizes a passion for DVDs. Just provide a photograph of your collection and explain a little bit about it. The grand prize is a 400-disc mega DVD changer and a free lifetime membership to PeerFlix. You do not need to be a PeerFlix member to enter. Learn more at blog.peerflix.com. That's the PeerFlix blog, blog.peerflix.com.
And if you sign up for a PeerFlix account between now and Tuesday, June 6th, you'll be entered to win the Platoon 20th Anniversary Collector's Edition out on DVD this week, along with The Smokey and the Bandit Special Edition, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane 2-Disc Special Edition, Date Movie Unrated, and Volume 2 of the Bette Davis Collection, including Jezebel and The Man Who Came to Dinner.
Sam, it's time for us to thank the people who have so generously donated to us through our PayPal link on the filmspotting.net site. Take it away.
Yeah, we want to thank Mark, the Atlanta Hammer. We want to thank Dennis, the Sum of All Things, Patrick, the Mountain Missive, Ayan, the Giddy Gupta, a.k.a. Shashanka, James, Ancient Wall of Fists, O, last initial O, and James, Fear Itself, Last Initial L. And we've got two gold members included in there. That's James, Ancient Wall of Fists, O, and Dennis, the Sum of All Things. Thank
Gold
you so
Club
much,
members.
Gold Club members.
We appreciate that. We also have some poll questions. Of course, last week on the Film Spotting site, we asked you, will you see the planned Wolverine X-Men spinoff? They're already talking about, supposedly, this is a done deal.
Of course.
Hugh Jackman's going to be back as Wolverine in his own movie. The options, yes, Wolverine is a badass. Maybe who's directing? And no, not into comic books. And maybe who's directing won with 45% of the vote, but it was close. Yes, Wolverine is a badass, 42% of the vote. And finally, no, not into comic books, or some version of no,
yeah,
was in last place with only 14%. So obviously it sounds like our listeners on the whole would be interested in a Wolverine spinoff.
And yourself?
I voted for, as I said last week with Scott, I voted for yes, I would see it because he's a badass. You, Sam?
Yeah, again, well, for me, maybe who's directing. I think as much as I like Jackman, and but if maybe we get the same, you know, team of screenplay writers, I don't know if we
maybe
really
not.
Need to see him, you know, one-lining his way through a movie. But.
Exactly. This week's poll question on filmspotting.net, Vince Vaughn's act is... ... and this is, of course, in honor of The Breakup opening
right.
this weekend. Vince Vaughn's act is hilarious, amusing enough, or tired. Currently, the voting is...
Yeah, currently, with a relatively small number of votes in right now, but amusing enough is coming in at 47%, followed by hilarious at 34%, and tired. Vince Vaughn's act is tired at 19%.
And your vote went
too. My vote is hilarious. Come
on.
Of course. This guy can't quit. This guy is on a roll. And as long as, I mean, we'll see if he can get through the breakup with Jennifer Aniston. You know, I will laugh at just about everything that comes out of the guy's mouth from old school on. Yeah,
I
and Swingers,
have
course,
always
yeah.
been a huge fan of Vince Vaughn until Made. He's actually so annoying in that film that he
annoying.
Made me not like Vince Vaughn. But
yeah.
he was
he
one of the few
himself,
bright
yeah.
spots in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and he's good in Wedding Crashers.
Yes.
So I voted, though, for Amusing Enough. I'm
really?
Still not giving him the hilarious check mark yet. Sorry. One other note we wanted to mention just real quick. You can see what movies we're planning to review coming up over the next few weeks by going to filmspotting.net and clicking on the calendar page. And right now, we've been doing a lot of mainstream stuff because
yeah,
there's
yeah.
some mainstream stuff worth talking about and that we're interested in. And there's some more mainstream stuff coming up after X-Men, The Breakup, A Prairie Home Companion, though I don't know how mainstream,
yeah,
but it's opening wide. And then also Nacho Libre, the Jack Black movie.
Which, I just want to put this out right
yeah.
there, right now. I think Nacho Libre is going to make $1 trillion this summer.
Trillion.
I just feel like I get a sense. I was watched the preview before X-Men the other day, and there's just a quality of the audience response that I'm like. And you've said you're not so impressed by the preview. You like Jack Black enough,
yes.
but I don't know. Something about it strikes me as like this is going to make you know, it's just
I think
Fort Knox gold.
It could do that, or it could literally be a bomb. So we'll have to wait and see.
Okay, that's really
but,
walking the line there.
Yeah, I know.
It's
thank
either
you.
One or the
well,
other.
Well, I'm saying you know,
or it could make a cool $55 million.
No, that's not what it won't make 55. That's exactly what I'm saying.
All right,
but. I brought up the calendar because I did want to mention that there are all sorts of interesting
yes.
art house movies that usually we talk about here on Film Spotting,
right.
but with these mainstream movies coming out, we've kind of missed them, and so we're going to make an effort at the end of June to have sort of an art house roundup and talk
yep.
about at least Lady Vengeance, which is the latest entry in you know the Old Boy series from
right.
Park Chan-wook. We're going to definitely talk about that, and also hopefully The Proposition, this
yeah,
Australian Western from Nick Cave, really dark. Sadistic, so Sam will hate it.
Yep.
We're looking forward to that.
right.
I'm also going to try to see, maybe Sam, you're going to find time, hopefully, maybe to see Down in the Valley,
yeah.
Army of Shadows, Art School
There's
Confidential.
A lot of good things
some
out
of
there,
these
yeah.
these art movies that are out here, some are getting rave reviews, others are getting only sort of average reviews, but we're interested in seeing them. We know you probably are too, and so we're going to try to get to a few of them and talk
about
them.
And why that weekend and not others? Well, maybe it's because Adam Sandler's Click is opening that weekend, which
That's,
just looks... Yeah, abysmal.
That's a good point. That's
yeah.
why we're doing the
that's
art
why
house
we're
roundup
doing it.
Then, because
yeah.
we don't really want to talk about Click.
Right.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about top five performances a little bit. Sam,
right.
you were gone last week, so we didn't really get a chance to get into this. And we do want to briefly thank Scott Smith
yes,
again.
Yes, great
for
job
filling
last
in.
Week.
Did a great job on Film Spotting 101. But on our deluxe 100th episode, we did our top five performances along with the help of Scott Ferguson and Dylan Kidd. And, of course, we got some feedback saying,
yes.
how could you leave off
right.
some of these people? And we agree many of them are great choices, so
yeah.
why don't we dive into the mailbag here?
And we set it up a little bit coming into the break, but this email from Paul should straighten things out here. Subject line, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. Paul writes, I just finished listening to the first half hour of your 100th show, and I was amazed to hear that even though there were over 15 performances mentioned, Bill Murray was nowhere to be found among best male comedics. Stripes, Groundhog Day, Caddyshack, all very funny, but then there's Dr. Pete, Back Off Man, I'm a Scientist, Venkman, the cynic in a group of unorthodox scientists. It's a role that could have easily been standard comic relief, but Murray takes it to another level and makes it unforgettable.
I agree. He's brilliant as Peter Venkman. He's great in Caddyshack and Stripes. He's great in Groundhog Day.
We like Bill Murray.
I really did consider putting him on, and as Peter Venkman was the role I was probably going to put him on from Ghostbusters, but I just couldn't find room for him, I agree he probably belongs there.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree.
This one from Jay Pascal. She says, I think one of the best female performances ever is Sissy Spacek in Coal Miner's Daughter. Surprised she didn't even get an honorable mention. Glad you mentioned Naomi Watts, as she is incredible, but Sam?
Yeah, totally. I mean, again, it was on the short list. I mean, I looked at that, and I just... I don't know. I don't know really. You look back at all these performances, as we did, putting these lists together, and it's just like you look for one thing that's just like a spark of something that reminded you, one scene. And maybe it's like, yes, that performance is absolutely brilliant, but there wasn't maybe that one scene that I was reminded of.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Didn't put it over
the
top.
But we love her performance in that film. But how about one we got right, Sam?
How about this? Thank you, Sam. Subject line. This is Ross in Jerusalem, Israel, writing, Hey guys, I was walking down the street of Jerusalem listening to the top five male dramatic performances and almost killed an old woman when I heard Sam's number one pick. I am a huge fan of Gangs in New York, especially Daniel Day-Lewis's performance as Bill the Butcher Cutting. When a friend said he wasn't that good, it hurt. When he didn't win the Oscar for Best Actor, I was crushed. At this point, I thought I was alone, but Sam has restored my faith that there is good in this world. As I'm a pretty new listener, starting with show 80, I have been undecided on the Adam versus Sam issue, but now it's all different, Sam. I'd take a bullet for you.
Wow. Wow, that's... I mean, that's heavy stuff.
I mean,
there,
I don't want to be insensitive at all, but Ross is writing from Jerusalem, and he does write, I just want to remind you, that I've restored his faith that there is good in this world. This is one of the... This region is being torn apart by hatred, and just with
one simple choice.
My number one.
You did it.
Best performance.
And it would have been coincidental, actually. It would have been a nice bit of coincidence if he had actually killed that old woman, because that's what Bill the Butcher would
have
done.
That's what he would have appreciated.
So maybe he should have done that. Scott Knopf from San Francisco, California writes in his top five female comedic, and I chose to read Scott's email, Sam, because I like all five of these performances, or I should say all four on here that I've seen, and so I considered them, and I want to read them. He has number five, Parker Posey as Libby May Brown in Waiting for Guffman. She is hilarious. Alicia Silverstone in Clueless. I think Clueless is underrated. I think it's a good movie. I think she's good in it. He's got Frances McDormand from Fargo. I had her on my list as well. He's got Katharine Hepburn as Susan Vance in Bringing Up Baby. It's going to be part of our Screwballs Comedy Marathon coming up after Herzog. And number one, Claudette Colbert as Ellie Andrews in It Happened One Night. Colbert's performance is comedy defined perfect. I can't say enough, so I'll stop here. I agree. She's really fantastic, and It Happened One Night. I like all five of those choices. Good job, Scott.
Nice. All right. Here's one subject line, glaring omission from Oscar in Stockholm, Sweden. He writes, I'm sorry, but it's a crime. Yes, a crime to exclude Marlon Brando as Stanley Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire from the top five male dramatic performances. This is a movie that changed acting forever, method acting like no other. I'm absolutely floored that this wasn't in any of the more than 15 picks either you guys or Dylan Kidd made. I'm in shock, honestly. Adam said something that captures what a great performance is. It's the actor should be invisible. All you can see is the character. It's more true of this role than any other. Brando isn't acting in the movie. He is Stanley Kowalski.
Again, what can we say?
I think Brando is terrible. I'm just kidding.
My heart stopped.
I saw your. I wish this is where we need video podcasting. Yeah. Adam was about to shut off the mics and send me home.
I literally was about to cut
early to bed. I mentioned during the 100th show that I couldn't believe that De Niro, Pacino, and Brando didn't appear anywhere on my lists. And part of it was just like, you don't want to fill a slot with a really obvious pick, but he's absolutely right. I mean, you know, Brando's absolutely amazing in Streetcar Named Desire, but he's incredible in The Godfather. He's incredible in just about every film. And looking back at the list and listening to the show again, I realized how many actors and actresses were penalized by being too good in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't decide.
Right.
So I put in, you know, The Limey.
Right.
You know, or something like that. You know, it's like a great performance that I love, but how am I going to pick between...
Well, if it makes parts. Yeah, if it makes you feel any better, Oscar, I don't know if Oscar is a Dope Sheet subscriber or not, but in a recent edition of the Dope Sheet, I included Scott Ferguson's complete list of his different categories of his favorite performances, and he actually had his all-time favorite performance. Yeah. Doesn't even belong in a category. He had Brando in both Last Tango in Paris and On the Waterfront, so he gave Marlon Brando some love as the all-time pantheon performance, and it's hard to argue with that. All right, we've got a number of other emails we could get to, some performance stuff, and also some Da Vinci Code feedback. We will get to a little bit of that here in the next segment, but if you've got feedback for us, send an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA. That's 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, all right, who's down with G.O.D.? Another round of Massacre Theater, including this week's winner, and a preview of Friday's Top 5 Screen Parents are next. Stay with us.
Haven't seen you in a while. You smell of celluloid and plastic coats your smile, but I can see the sunlight you keep hidden in your hair. Irrelevant but true, I miss you. Irrelevant but true. Haven't seen you in a while. Anytime I need your voice, I can just pick up and dial, because the telephone is a safe device. You can't hear the tears that drown my eyes. Irrelevant but true, I miss you. Irrelevant but true.
Veronica, acting all pure. What about last spring break at the Promise Makers rally, huh?
Oh, my God. You are making accusations.
As we're trying to save your soul. Mary, turn away from Satan. Jesus, he loves you.
You don't know the first thing about love.
I am filled with Christ's love.
God.
You are just jealous of my success in the Lord.
This is not a weapon, you idiot.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Hallgren. Time now for Massacre Theater. Last week, Adam and guest host Scott Smith massacred the scene you just heard from Saved with Mandy Moore and Jenna Malone, a tie-in with our top five religious movies. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is, would you believe, I'm serious, the winner is, Sam, Christian Clarion from San Francisco, California.
Unbelievable.
Christian Clarion, congratulations. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice. And before we get to this week's installment of Massacre Theater, I just want to briefly mention that maybe it was our brilliant portrayals of Jenna Malone. It was a record-setting number of entries for Massacre Theater, just edged out, and I mean just edged out, Dr. Strangelove as the most popular Massacre Theater.
Amazing.
Yet a ton of feedback from people saying they really enjoy this movie, Saved, and that was great to hear.
Yeah,
only
a
few
movie,
people saying they don't like it, and Scott and I both like it. You like
I
it.
I like it.
As well.
I want to bring up one more point.
Okay.
You let Scott touch the Film Spotting hat.
I've never touched that.
I've never chosen the winner, and you let guest host Scott Smith.
Uh-huh. Well, you have to earn it, Sam. You have to earn it, okay?
All right.
So pick up your game.
I don't know how. What does that mean? I don't know how to interpret that.
There is one other note, because several listeners pointed this out. I picked the screenplay, the scene from the screenplay online, and sometimes when you get these online screenplays,
they're slightly different.
They don't show you. We actually had the correct dialogue, but they don't show you who's saying the lines. So sometimes you really have to decipher who's doing the talking. And it does turn out that we had at the end of our scene, the line about the Vespa wasn't Mandy Moore. It was actually Patrick Fugit.
I was going to say that had to be Fugit. Who were the Vespa?
Yeah. So
I thought that was strange.
So we kind of botched that.
I would have written in. If I was a listener, I would have written in.
I know you
would have,
Sam. That's why you don't get to touch the hat. Okay, it's Massacre Theater time, and of course it is tying in with our top five screen parents. We'll get into that a little bit more here in a moment, but think about parents, movies that deal heavily with parenting, family dysfunction, that kind of fun stuff. And Sam, I start it, so you give me the action.
That's right. And action.
You can make up to $100,000 your first year. You should have seen the boat this Oriental guy had. He even had his own game show in China. He had so much money. I think Mark would be perfect for it.
Ma, shut up about those fucking tapes, okay? It's a scam.
Well, I'm doing it. I'm saving up for those tapes because I know what you could be if you just apply yourself.
You know what? I do apply myself, Mom. I work my ass off burying dead people, okay? I'm only 26. I'm not in a rush. What's your rush for? Just let me be. I don't rush you.
Okay, then I'll do them myself.
Fine, do them.
Okay, then. I won't let you on my yacht.
And scene.
All right, if you know what film Sam and I just massacred, send an email by Monday, June 5th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Tuesday's show. We're planning to have the show up on Tuesday instead of Wednesday, so look for shows next week on Tuesday and Friday. Before we get into the top five preview here, Screen Parents, we did want to tie up listener feedback here real quick. We had some Da Vinci Code feedback that we wanted to share, but also with our performances, we had a ton of great emails of omissions and some people agreeing with our choices and some great top five lists, and we just can't get to them all. And Sam, you're actually going to be handling the dope sheet this week.
That's right.
You're going to get to one or two more entries from listeners here in the dope sheet. So if you haven't subscribed to that yet, you need to do that. And you also want to mention Dylan Kidd.
Yes.
Some people wrote in and said, okay, you're always talking about Roger Dodger.
Right.
We love it. That's why we got Dylan Kidd, the writer-director of that film, to be on the show. It was a real honor for us.
Yes, it was.
But he also made the film P.S., came out after Roger Dodger, his
starring.
Second film, starring the age-appropriate character delivery device, Laura Linney. And we had some listeners write in and say, so where do you guys stand on P.S.? And Sam, you are happy to report.
I'm happy to report, and we both watched it over the past week or since recording episode 100. It's very good. Not only is it good, I'd say the movie is good. Laura Linney, and I know people are going to think that I'm doing this to kiss Dylan Kidd's ass. I'm pretty sure he listened to 100 and won't listen to it again. So just get that out of your head. Laura Linney gives one of the best female performances I've seen in the last couple of years. I was reminded, we both saw this recently too, Kira Sedgwick in Personal Velocity. This kind of performance that reminds you that there are so few good roles for women out there. Laura Linney is fantastic, as is a film spotting favorite, Topher Grace, in P.S. as well. But she's really phenomenal and is given a lot to work with and is treated like an adult in an adult situation.
Yeah.
And the film has its flaws. I think we can agree with that. But her performance really is completely outstanding.
It is. It is very good. Laura Linney's fantastic in it. You have always been
hard on her on this show.
She
was the age-appropriate character delivery device for P.S. as well.
Yeah,
in a good way.
But she was able to turn out a good performance, and I agree. I thought she was really good, and I watched it not knowing if you were going to see it, and I thought, wow, Sam's going to have a hard time ripping on her for this performance because she's good. And Topher Grace,
she should have been nominated.
Him.
The film was received very mixed by critics and really
I'm a little mixed on it too.
We're not going to get into it. No, it's not. And it's a totally different kind of film, certainly, but it's worth seeing. I mean, a little overlooked DVD pick, track it down. It's worth seeing for those two performances, Topher Grace and Laura Linney.
Okay, well, Brian Drake writes in about the Da Vinci Code, and he says that he wanted to thank us for setting up a surprising experience. My fiance had already set up an outing to go see it for her mother's birthday prior to your review. She and her entire family had already read it prior to seeing the movie. I passed on it, as I normally skip books everyone else is reading. After Adam and Scott's review, I was expecting a snooze fest. However, I was pleasantly surprised. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Having never read the book, I had no expectations and found myself interested in the movie from start to finish. I'm not sure if I'd sit through the movie again, but your review was just enough Novocaine to get me through the experience. So I love being thanked for disagreeing with him. But it's interesting that we set up this kind of low expectations for him, and he enjoyed it. And I wanted to address Brian's email because I do think it's worth noting that even though Scott and I just ripped this movie apart...
Yeah.
I did, you know, give it 2 stars. I didn't hate the movie, and I would say
it's just boring.
It's just boring. Yeah. That's it. It's not that I'm surprised that people got into it at all, or that some people are enjoying it. It's not like it's the most dreadful experience of the summer. It's just boring.
Right. It's not at any point. Yeah. Is it involving? Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, finally, on that note, maybe it is a mediocre film-going experience, and certainly David L. Williams in New York, New York would agree. He writes that so Ron Howard created a movie that looks nice but is ultimately boring and empty. I find myself something less than shocked. Ron Howard is maybe the least interesting, successful director working today. It's not that he makes bad movies. They're not ambitious enough to reach the level of bad. 5 minutes after I've seen any of his movies, I've already forgotten what was on screen. In fact, in Sweden, all of his movies are given similar names so that the moviegoers know it's a Ron Howard film.
David is apparently a world traveler. Let's hear him.
Including mediocre firemen, mediocre astronauts, mediocre Grinch, mediocre crazy genius, mediocre old people, mediocre Irish Tom Cruise, mediocre boxer, mediocre married Jesus, and of course, mediocre mermaid. And that's David L. Williams.
Though he does admit that he actually kind of likes Splash.
Yeah, and I do too. And we like, of course, Cinderella Man.
Yes, we very much do. But otherwise, we appreciate David's Swedish movie titles entry there for Ron
Howard. What's interesting? When I watched The Da Vinci Code, I was down in Birmingham, Alabama, and I was at a wedding. It's what I was doing there. And I happened to see the film with somebody who works in Hollywood on making movie posters. She actually works for an agency that creates movie posters. And so she had a really interesting perspective on The Da Vinci Code posters, which we can all admit are totally ineffective and boring. I mean, we've got Tom Hanks and Audrey Tautou just sort of staring blankly out at the corner of 52nd and Broadway or something. I mean, it's really strange. And she said, like, you look back at all of his movie posters, they're just generic. They're just generic and boring and unimaginative. And she says, with something like this, that's something the director, somebody of, you know, of a stature of Ron Howard, is directing in a way. This isn't some agency that's a lousy at promoting the film, but... And it's an interesting way to look at it. It's just
some
like,
people think he's a bland director, and he has bland movie posters.
It's consistent anyway.
It is. Well, it's time for our preview of our top five. This week, we went with Screen Parents. And
that's right.
At first, the connection might not be clear to X-Men, but if you've seen it or you know a little bit about the storyline, you do know that it is kind of a wasted storyline with the
right.
character Angel, but it is his father who wants to cure his son
right.
who creates this mutant cure. And also, we got this great email from Ann Kerrigan in Jacksonville, Florida, because on our calendar page, we had a blank there. We didn't know what we were going to do for our top five. And she wrote in and said, the week of May 31st is just about midway between the U.S. designated holidays for Mother's Day and Father's Day. You've done child protagonists, marriage and relationships, and while this might cross over with your hero's choices, how about picking your top five movie parents? I'll leave you to decide whether you want to make that parents one would actually want to have, or portrayals that typify something about parents which might not be so great. So, Anne, we appreciate that email, and I will throw Anne's question on to you, Sam. What did you go with?
Well, I think at first I thought maybe there'd be more crossover with movies about marriage, but really I think there's maybe only one film that that crosses over both lists. And I found that you'll see that there are good and bad parents reflected on my list.
Okay.
My 6 through 10, Chishu, Ryu, and Chieko Higashiyama.
Tokyo Story. I knew you were going to do it.
as the sort of grandparents that come and visit their wayward children in Tokyo. And it's really one of the first things I thought of. They're fantastic. I have Midnight Run, a tie. Midnight Run and True Romance, because it's one of my favorite scenes in movies, is when Robert De Niro goes and needs to borrow his ex-wife's car, and he has that awkward scene with his daughter. And he says, oh, you in the eighth grade? I mean, and that's all they've got to say to each other.
Uh-huh.
And it's perfectly captured. And of course, the scene with Dennis Hopper as Clifford Worley with Christopher Walken defending his son, refuses to give up.
Yeah.
Give up where his
classic
son is.
Scene.
Classic scene. So I had to give it up for there. Another favorite of mine, Raising Victor Vargas, Alta Gracia Guzman, who raises Victor Vargas and his two siblings. I mentioned it in my favorite performances list a couple weeks ago. I love the performance. She's the best grandma ever. But a fantastic, fantastic scene when she sort of like wants to actually give up Victor Vargas. He's too much trouble and corrupting, and she brings him and wants him to be adopted by the state. Fantastic scene. Lawrence Fishburne is Jason Furious Styles in Boys in the Hood. The movie is memorable most of all for his performance. I think he's fantastic in it. And finally, another tie, a pairing that's come up a couple times on Film Spotting, Spellbound and Capturing the Friedmans. I mean, these are all about, my God, you talk about, particularly with Capturing the Friedmans, of course, that family is just deeply and profoundly screwed up. Spellbound is all about the nature of families and parents and good and bad parents, but it's a favorite film of mine. So
okay, some great choices there. I've got in my 6 through 10 here, not a surprise probably, H.I. and Edwina McDonough, Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter in Raising Arizona. They were in my top five comedic performances, both of them. And then a tie with another great 80s comedy, one that I felt so bad about leaving off my comedic performances list, Jack Butler, Michael Keaton in Mr. Mom. I love that film.
Nice.
I've also got Grace Stewart, Nicole Kidman as the mom in The Others, and a performance that made your top five male dramatic, Wilson, Terrence Stamp in The Limey.
Oh,
I mean, again,
pick.
He's not maybe much of a dad, but the movie is all about him getting vengeance anyway for his daughter.
Where's
I've also
Jenny?
Got, yeah.
Tell me about Jenny.
Yeah,
nicely done. I've also got Royal Tenenbaum, Gene Hackman in The Royal Tenenbaums, and I had to kick out just before we started recording, Sam. I had to kick out. It hurt me to kick Albert Brooks as Marlin from Finding Nemo.
Oh, come on.
Out of the list.
You
just
dad.
Giving up my hipster credibility. Just take my ID card because I'm a father of two young
right.
kids. I did kick him out, though, so I could get my hipster card back, and so I could put in Bernard Berkman, Jeff Daniels in The Squid and the Whale. I think this is what I said to you when I told you that I was going to throw him on, is that The Squid and the Whale, even though I like the movie quite a bit, he's the reason I would tell people to watch the film, is that performance.
It's a transcendent performance.
Yeah, he's really good and a really
interesting... One of the worst dads on film.
Yeah, maybe one of the worst dads ever. So there we go.
All right. Well, those are the movies that just missed our cut. Tune in Friday to hear our top five. Please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on our blog, sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. Each week in The Dope Sheet, we'll give away a copy of the self-titled CD from Keith Jenkins and the Moving Parts to one random Dope Sheet subscriber. You can hear Keith on Film Spotting 101, courtesy of Reverbose Records.
On Friday's show, Sam and I kick off our Werner Herzog Klaus Kinski Marathon with 1972's Aguirre, The Wrath of God, plus your top five religious movies feedback and our top five screen parents. Thanks to The Great Distance for today's music. Please check them out on the web at thegreatdistance.co.uk. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Holgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And also by Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. A VTEC engine, anti-lock braking system, and front side and side curtain airbags are standard. And for added style, there's the Fit Sport Automatic with rear roofline spoiler and wheel-mounted paddle shifters. The Honda Fit is set and ready to go. Check it out at fit.honda.com.